All right, welcome to JavaScript Jam. What's up, Ishan? There
There we go. Can you hear me now?
you go. I can hear you now.
Yeah. Let me retweet this or repost it as it's now being called.
Oh, yes.
Oh, hang on. Let me give me a second. I need to switch my connectivity.
Are you on your phone or your computer?
I am on my phone. And I've
Yeah,
forgotten that you can now join by desktop.
I
I
know.
haven't
I'm still
diehard.
using my phone just as force of a habit. I've been doing this too long, man. Too long to change now.
Yeah.
I
I remember the old days.
remember Clubhouse.
Yeah, exactly. Hang on just a
Yeah,
second.
take your
You
time.
had to be iOS only
Yeah,
yeah,
I'll give
back
us a little
then.
intro while you. While you go, welcome everyone to JavaScript Jam, where we talk about the JavaScript news of the week. We had a double feature in our newsletter this week for Stories of the Week. Both of them very interested to talk to Ishan about. I think they're pretty exciting projects. We got JSR, the first ever serious competitor, in my opinion, to NPM. And we also have React 19 coming at you. Feels like just 5 years ago, React 18 came out, you know? So, you know, they're probably due for one, I would say. But
Yeah.
let me go ahead and share
Yeah, why don't
those
you yeah, why
on
don't
the
you post the
doobly-doo.
newsletter, on the
Yep.
Dumbotron while I kick us off. Well, welcome everyone to JavaScript Jam. We sometimes call this JavaScript Jam Live. JavaScript Jam is sometimes a YouTube channel, sometimes a podcast, sometimes a Twitter space, and all of the above. And we call JavaScript Jam Live the twice a month conversation we have on. Oh, it's also a newsletter, which, by the way, if you've not subscribed, go to javascriptjam.com and hit the subscribe button. But live is our chance to get closer to the audience, so to speak. And we often discuss what's in that newsletter, which Anthony is going to post on the Jumbotron. But also anything the audience wants to talk about. We very much view this as an open mic. Anything that's JavaScript or web development related is on topic. The newsletter is, Anthony has a great job, is designed to inform and also stimulate conversation. But some of my favorite, conversations happen because somebody, came raised their hand and said, "I want to talk about X. This is I'm seeing on my Twitter feed." And then, sometimes we don't even have the answer, and somebody else from the audience is able to answer. So those have been some of my favorites. So don't be shy. Feel free to, hit the request button. We're happy to bring anyone to the stage or answer any other questions. With that, I should introduce myself. My name is Ishan Nand. I'm the VP of the Applications Platform here at Edgio.
And I am Anthony Campolo, developer advocate here at Edgio.
So, you did mention those are the features. But one of the things I liked, by the way, about having you do the newsletter is like you pick different things to highlight than I would. There are some great things in there, but like the things that jump to me that I would have put as feature are slightly different.
I'd like to
Yeah.
hear, be curious to hear what those are then.
You want to start with those, or yeah, we can start with those, and then we well, it sounds like you were dying to talk about JSR, which is really important, and React 19. We can talk about React 19 because that was on my list as well. But the other things that were on my list that you had was kirimase.dev, which is like trying to build Ruby on Rails. The Node.js trailer, I remember when Node came out. I have, let's call it, contrarian opinions about that. I thought the quick innovations were really interesting and fascinating. I wanted to get your opinion on Redwood JS 7. So those are the things that I thought. Oh, and Core of Vitals was the most pressing and important thing to me, because that's like a freight train coming at the web right now in like less than, well, basically like 2 weeks, March 12th.
Which
Yeah.
what are you referring to in terms of Core Web Vitals?
So Google is switching the Core of Vitals from these three metrics. They're swapping one of those metrics out. So
Yeah, INP, right?
yeah, they're switch
Yeah, I mean
INP.
that was a headline like 3 months ago or something in the
Yeah,
newsletter specifically. So like that's why I wouldn't have felt the need to include it in this week's. But did that switch happen now?
That happens in 2 weeks. You're absolutely right. We did cover it back then. And I
because we're that far ahead of the game.
Yeah, exactly. Well, so it's worth like
let's start with that. Let's talk about that.
Let's start with that. Yeah, it's a great one. So like it's very first of all, this is an announcement that's been a year coming. Google told us a year ago it was coming, and most people probably are, you know, put it off worrying about. So why is this even important? For most companies, for a lot of companies, especially e-commerce companies, Google is one of, you know, if not your number one, it's in your top three sources of traffic. Wolfgang Digital did a study and they found that Google organic traffic was something like 50% of a lot of e-commerce companies' traffic. So the traffic that Google sends you is hugely important. And as a result, your position on the SERP or search engine results page, right, those blue links is hugely important. It's actually a power law. So when you go from 1 to 2 to 3, you actually might go down, you know, a quarter of the traffic. So number one can get something like 4 times as much traffic as the one below, or, you know, 30% to basically a doubling, depending on the industry and the search term. So it's hugely important that you have the best possible search engine rank that you can. And what Google has said is one of the new factors that they rolled out a few years ago is this thing called Core Vitals, which rates how fast your website is. And since we're on audio, you can't see me putting fast in air quotes because these are user experience metrics. They're not performance metrics. People often say that Google's ranking your site by how fast it is, but not all three of the metrics are actually speed metrics. And so if your site is faster and passing these thresholds for these three metrics, then if there's a ranking tie, the faster one will win. And Google has said, to be fair, that the quality of the content is usually a stronger ranking factor than the speed. But this is why this means like huge amounts of money for folks. And they took one of those metrics, which is called first input delay, which is a metric I've never liked. I didn't like the one they had before, which was TTI or time to interactive. I can go on my rant about that, or I can point you to my YouTube video where I walk through an example of a very fast site that TTI says is slow. And they're replacing first input delay with another metric called INP, interaction to next paint. And I can get into briefly what those mean. But the key difference is those are very radically different metrics. So much so that you could be passing Core Vitals right now and you could be failing it, you know, starting on March 12th, simply because this by this new metric, you're failing because it measures something completely different.
Yeah, and this is super interesting because you and I, for, you know, years now, have been having this conversation about, yeah, you know, Core Vitals and Lighthouse and what are the things they measure are kind of the best way to really test the speed of a site. And you've been a big advocate of things like RUM, real user metrics, as a kind of more realistic benchmark. Do you feel like this gets us closer to a more useful pure metric that can be done in a lab kind of environment? Is that kind of the goal here?
I don't think that's the goal here. Let me back up and, you know, real user, explain for the audience the difference for anybody who's listening. So a test like Lighthouse is a simulated test or a lab test. You load up a web page in your browser, you run Lighthouse on it, and it's very consistent. You can try it the next day. It's the same machine. Hopefully you're not running a bunch of other things in the background. And it should be very, very repeatable. But it only tests your site's performance in the conditions that you tested it under. You know, if you're on your desktop with a great connection, it's really testing it there. And it can emulate what a mobile user might experience, but it doesn't emulate what your mobile users actually experience. Real user monitoring measures what's actually happening on the page. Every time somebody views your page, a bunch of little performance data is being captured and being sent back to some server and aggregated together. And I'd be remiss if I didn't say that, you know, Edgio has a free RUM library built into our platform that does support INP as well, so that you can measure that. The reason why your lab and RUM data don't always line up is because the profile of your users might not be the same as how you tested in Lighthouse. So a great example of this was actually during COVID, and somebody went and did a performance study of every state's COVID response page. This was for the vaccine rollout. And they went and they tested them all in Lighthouse. And they were like, I can't remember, some like 70% of them didn't pass. And then I went, I was, well, let's look at the RUM data. Let's look at the core web vitals. And it turns out like a lot of them, a bunch of them actually passed. In fact, there was one where the Lighthouse score was like red. And another where they're green across two different states. But the RUM data showed that they're both were passing. And this can happen because you might have a different set of demographics of, you know, users in terms of like iPhones versus Android, which tend to be slower, that might visit your site. You could have different size viewports, which might affect how like your LCP gets, or largest contentful pane, whether it shows up, like what the largest item on the page is, can change if the size of your screen changes. And that can change your LCP score, which is another of the core web vitals. It could be all your users are in one state and you hosted your website across the country in US East Virginia. And you're like, I don't know, the state of Oregon, when you should have done it, you know, in the Oregon data center. And so the, all those requests have to go further. And you might be, you know, a contractor sitting in the East Coast and thinking it's fine. So there's a lot of reasons that can happen. I think the change to from FID, first input delay, to INP was about something else. The problem with first input delay, as it's implied by the name, is that it only captures the very first interaction. And in fact, it doesn't even capture what you would think it captures. So people
can't you say though, I mean, just to play devil's advocate, couldn't you say the first interaction is extremely important?
You can. The problem is it's easy to get wrong or fool. So this is something actually in the podcast that you linked to, they talked about, and something I've talked about a lot. Sometimes the easiest way to hack core web vitals is to just put a loading spinner as your first loading thing. And then
right, because then it just it seemingly loads a whole page and then it's there. But really, I think you told me also like you could just give like a kind of like a white screen and just have it like kind of register that and then think that's the first page. So you're tricking it.
There's all sorts of people come with newer and newer hacks and they sometimes work around it. But in the case of first input delay, like a great example is, especially with like Next.js sites, which are server-side rendered, at first you get the server side, so you see the UI, and then it has to hydrate. And if somebody clicks on a button, because the page is server side rendered, you can see it, and there could be a button there, but the JavaScript hasn't been, you know, connected to it because the page isn't hydrated. And if all that JavaScript is downloading, you can, it has or hasn't, you know, even run yet. You can click on it, nothing will happen. But first input delay will say you're done. Because the way first input delays, it just looks for the first interaction on the page and it says, could you have responded to that? It doesn't even measure if you did respond to it.
Interesting. So if you were to like add an island or something, which is this is one of the problems that's meant to solve, would that not really affect your first input delay?
Say that again, if you added an island.
Yeah, because the point of an island is this first interaction issue is that you want to just load like the single button so that someone could click that button, but you don't have to worry about all the interactivity down page.
Yes. Yeah. So if you isolate that to an island, then all that island's JavaScript could load. But like to first input delay, that actually might be worse. Like just having a button that is non-functional is fine to first input delay. It's the idea that like first input delay is a poor measurement of what they're trying to capture, which is how interactive.
Okay, I think I understand now. Yeah.
Right. So there's actually a great analogy on the JavaScript Jabber podcast, which I really loved, which is imagine you go into a bar and it's really busy. And so it takes you a while to ask for a drink, but then it may take them a while to get you the drink and bring it back. And all first input delay measures is how long did it take you to place your order to the bartender? Now, the bartender could give it to you immediately, or he could get like a bunch of other orders and get busy and not give it to you for a while. But it just measures how long did it take you to be able to give your order. And so what happens, you know, to make that concrete inside the browser is if there's another piece of JavaScript running when somebody clicks and it takes longer than 50 seconds for that JavaScript to finish so the click handler can run, then it says, you know, you're being slow. If it has to wait longer than that amount of time. And that's effectively first input delay. And one of the problems here is it's very dependent on when the user clicks. So if the user clicks, like imagine you got two big pieces of JavaScript that need to execute. And if they click in between those two pieces and there's no JavaScript running, then it will seem fine. First input delay, you could have responded, even if you didn't, because that JavaScript hadn't loaded the second piece. But to first input delay, it's okay. So it's really, really subject to a lot of vagaries. And in practice, a lot of sites don't have trouble passing first input delay. In our experience, it's actually one of the easiest, well, I wouldn't say the easiest, but one of the least likely to have problems, even if you think of the site as being slow. Because the first input actually tends to, for a variety of reasons, as measured by RUM, tends to be fine. And so what INP tries to do is it really tries to say, well, over the lifetime of the page, the entire session, how interactive does this page feel? It's a much better sense of like, is this page usable? So that loading spinner isn't necessarily going to show up if after the loading spinner is done, everything else comes on. And if the site's taking a while to paint, like the whole process of taking the click and responding and having a paint happen afterwards is now part of the measurement. And it's actually measuring it for the entire lifetime of the page. It's looking at the whole page. It sometimes in cases will throw out, you know, outliers for really, really long occasional requests. But it's basically trying to capture over the whole lifetime of the page. Every time the user clicks, do we get a paint very quickly back? Whereas first input delay only looked at the very first click and didn't even bother to look at how long it took to paint. So I think it's a much better sense of interaction. I think that's what the change is here. I mean, the real goal of CoreWeb Vitals is, you know, the web went through this, I don't want to call it identity crisis, over like the last decade and a half, maybe two decades of mobile, where we had to compete with native applications. And native applications are competing with the web on device. And those experiences are fast and compelling. And we've been trying to find a way for the web to compete with that. And nobody is more incentivized, even though Google owns Android, so much of their business comes from the web. They want the web to feel as good as native. And it's trying to get that experience bar. That's why you have a metric about three different things that aren't really performance. They're actually about user experience. The first one is how fast does it load, right? Your native app loads very quickly. So that's covered by LCP. The second one is how fast does it take to interact with? How fast does it take to respond when I'm playing with it? Native apps are notoriously a lot faster. And the last one is one, this is why you have cumulative layout shift. Web pages, historically, when you'd load a web page, like lots of people would not put the height and image on various items on images. And the browser wouldn't know how big that image would be, and it would put a placeholder, and then it would download the image and really know how big it was. And so web pages have a habit of, as different things come in and load, they're jumping all around the place. Native apps never did that. Or for the most part, they don't. It's possible to end up with that situation. And so when you look at those three metrics, really, I view it as trying to make the web compete with native on mobile. That, to me, was the impetus. And this is just refining that to better capture it. So that's my soapbox. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, no, that's cool. A couple follow-up things. I posted our, and this is actually, it was almost a year ago now, I posted the original article where we talked about this back in May. And I had linked to a guide that kind of split optimization strategies into two buckets that can cause poor IMP. One was excessive JavaScript. So they recommended things like refining long tasks, reducing input delay, evaluating your scripts, and utilizing a web worker. What they should say here is use PartyTown. And then slow rendering, which is you want to avoid complex layouts. You want to reduce your CSS style calculations that you can do now with all your fancy CSS. Keep your DOM a reasonable size. And look at your client-side rendering of HTML. Do those sound like still good strategies based on what you know about this metric, or are there other things you would want our listeners to know about?
No, I think those are good strategies. I think the first thing I always say is actually the number one thing is, like, people run Lighthouse, and I would say first look at your core vitals, or look at your RUM data before you do anything else.
What do you mean by that? Look at core vitals instead of Lighthouse, because I thought Lighthouse showed you your core web vitals.
Oh, so okay, Lighthouse. So there's Page Speed Insights. I think that's what they still call it. Let me go to the website. So Page Speed Insights.
Right.
will show you both your Core Web Vitals and your Lighthouse score. So it'll show you both lab and field. And it used to actually give you a number at the top, and that was Lighthouse. And then right underneath it, it gave you the field data. So it was really, really confusing in their layout. And so that's what I mean by, so Lighthouse is a, you know, either you run on your computer or you go to PageSpeed Insights, which will run it for you. But that's the part where you, when you type a URL into PageSpeed Insights, the part at the top now is just the field data at the top. And it'll say Core Vitals Assessment, and it'll give you your Core Vitals. And then below that, it says Diagnose Performance Issues. And that will spin as it's running the lab test and give you those, you know, four numbers with the inside the circles that tell you how well you're performing according to their simulation. And those two may or may not be aligned. And so that's why I say start. Now I can tell people where I couldn't before, just start at the top of the PageSpeed Insights and work your way down. And if everything at the top is green, then you don't have to worry as much about things at the down below. And if the things at the top are not green, focus on the ones that are red. Like if your cumulative layout shift is your problem, then it's unlikely, you know, shrinking the size of your JavaScript is going to help at all with that. And so you need to look at where you're failing first in Core Vitals before you go into Lighthouse to diagnose a problem. You have to know, you know, it's kind of like you want to know what the problem is before you go in and try and do surgery on the site. I did a... Yeah, go ahead.
Are you talking about the tab where it says discover what your real users are experiencing?
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, so for mine, I just tried my own website. It says no data. The Chrome user experience report does not have sufficient real-world speed data for this page, so I just get a single number. This is why I was really confused what you were saying. So I'm like, I've never gotten two numbers from PageSpeed Insights.
Okay, so type in, I don't know, like Amazon.com, right? Anything really big, and you'll get two numbers, or two sets of numbers. And the other thing you'll notice...
Oh, wow, this looks... very different.
Exactly. So this is what your real users are experiencing. And then actually at the upper right, you'll notice actually directly to the right where it says discover what your real users are experiencing, it says this origin and then this URL. And so one is for your Core Vitals across the whole domain. And the other one is for the Core Vitals for that particular URL. So if you just type in Amazon.com, it'll be for, it defaults to this URL right now. So it's just for the homepage. But if you want to know what the whole of your website or whatever website you're looking at, hit origin and it will give you for the entire website.
Yeah, and there's an interesting thing here, just since we're already talking about IMP. When I do that, when I switch from this URL to origin, it gives a little warning next to IMP and says, in rare cases like this, the histogram data may not reflect the 75th percentile number. The 75th percentile is always used to assess if the metric is passing. So I guess that's just kind of saying statistical artifacts can kind of affect your score.
Yeah, I should dig into... So I know that INP trims outliers. That might be what that artifact is referring to. I've encountered situations where Core Web Vitals be different from what the RUM data says for weird esoteric reasons. So for example, the browser, as it records Core Web Vitals data, has information across frame boundaries that are on different domains, but that's hidden from your RUM tools. So I, you know, when we built our RUM product, we were testing it and noticed that there was this discrepancy and sent the example to them. And they said, that's the reason. But this one right here, I don't know the specific details. It could be a statistical artifact. I'll have to dig into that one. I'm seeing that right now when I'm looking at, right now I pulled up Amazon, but that's a good question. But I'm not surprised in the aggregate, there can be a slight difference. But I did do a crash course in Core Web Vitals for React developers back in, it was 2021. And I should put that on the Jumbotron. Let me see and reply to the, let's see, I'll put it up here.
Yeah, I'm also looking at, I feel like we had an article on the Edgio blog that was going to come out about this. I just Googled IMP and Edgio, and I found an article from 2022 that talks about it a little bit, but I'm not sure if that article, the new one's gone live yet.
It looks like it hasn't, but we do have one that's coming out because IMP is obviously going to be very topical. And I just put it on the Jumbotron. So I gave this course crash course at React Day New York. The parts about LCP and CLS still apply, but obviously, you know, covered FID, first input delay, which is no longer relevant. But the actually the most valuable part, I feel, is the beginning of the class, the first half of the video.
It's not up on the Jumbotron, by the way.
Oh, it's not? I replied to the message, so let's see.
So wherever that is, then you have to click the share. Oh, do you reply to something else?
I replied to something else. So I know what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna send it back.
I mean, you could just share if you tweeted it anywhere. You can just share it on the Jumbotron, regardless of whether it's in the. Hold on, I'm just gonna go to your replies. Yeah, I see it now.
You see it now? Okay,
I got it. Yeah.
So,
because you replied to the view 3. There we go.
That's probably right. So I just say that the first part of it is still valid, and it's about the strategy for optimizing your site you should follow. So there's a whole workflow, like start with your RUM data, look at the problems that you've got, try to focus those in Lighthouse inside the lab. And then the other key point that's really important is you can't just roll out your change, because it's like an A-B test. Because Lighthouse and Core Vitals don't always line up, you need to test to make sure that things change. In fact, the ideal thing is to do an A-B test, because like you might have different traffic during different time periods. So you want to split your traffic between your fix and your original, and then see that the Core of Vitals is actually better. And so that I lay out, you know, how you'd actually do that workflow. And you know, that ability to split your traffic is also something that's non-trivial in a lot of platforms, but something we make easier in Edgio, specifically so you can A-B test performance. Because regular A-B testing actually hurts performance, but we do it in a way that doesn't do that. So
why does that hurt performance?
Well, regular A-B testing usually runs client-side. It usually uses some JavaScript. And so if it happens client-side, it means you're running more JavaScript, so it's going to slow down your page on the browser in order to change the DOM. And usually one of them is the control experiment, and that has no JavaScript running to change the DOM. And the second one will run JavaScript to change the DOM, and you'll do things like blanking the screen till the DOM change has taken effect. So your change, whatever your variant is actually going to be slightly slower to load. So it's not a true test of performance. It's a test of usability. But if in some cases I've seen like that blanking actually add, you know, hundreds of milliseconds. The other way you do it is you test it server side. But if you test it server side, most people don't preserve their cache. And so what happens is you're turning off caching for both pages in order to have two different variants. And it becomes hard to kind of manage. And so what we've built into our system is a very easy way to say, here's a variant, and it will make sure it preserves the cache key and fragments it according to the A-B test variant that's actually taking place inside the system. So basically the edge is talking to the thing that's controlling the experiment, making sure that it sorts the results appropriately. And then you go into our RUM tool, and you no longer have to configure the RUM tool. It already knows what your experiments are, and you can see the results. So basically all those pieces talk to each other, where normally you'd have to wire them up together.
When you say most people don't preserve their cache, do you mean most people running their code on the server, or most people browsing in their browser?
Ah, good question. I mean on the server. Most people who do an A-B test server side, they'll usually not preserve it on the cache.
Gotcha. Yeah, because I'm like, I know most people in their browser, their cache goes back 10 years.
No, it's when you're running on the server, it's you need to make sure you clear the cache in the right way. There's a lot of management headache. So if you like clear a certain, you know, maybe just a particular page, you need to clear both versions of it. You need to make sure that if you make a change to your A-B testing, that you've changed your cache keys appropriately, and yada, yada. So it's just a lot of management and workflow overhead. So it makes it harder. So like we had a customer who said, we now do A-B tests and Canary deploys on Fridays. It's just now so much easier. We're happy to roll it out. We know if there's a problem, we can turn one off and we don't have to worry about it. It makes things a lot easier.
You know how like some people will have, you know, they'll be like, one day I'll take a year long vacation and I'll study X and finally learn how it works. For me, that's like how to set the cache correctly. Cause I was broken by the Jamstack. I was like, why would I need to cache? Like, my site doesn't change.
You know, it's funny. I tweeted out, somebody tweeted, I think it was Who was it? Somebody tweeted out, like, is CDN caching still a thing? And I said,
it is for me, baby.
It got renamed to Jamstack. Jamstack certainly simplifies.
It didn't. Once they introduced all these, you know, the acronym soup, you know, all of a sudden you had to think about caching. So I that was kind of when I think me and a lot of people started checking out of the Jamstack.
Well, this is when, you know, I gave my talk. I called it the Jamstack Identity Crisis. Because what does it mean when you've got serverless in Jamstack? And my own answer to that is that the real value of Jamstack is to not about static. It's about bringing data to the edge and then making the rest of the infrastructure exposed to developers in a front-end friendly way. One that looks like, so basically what like ISR does is it's changing a bunch of things with caching you could do yourself, but it's exposing a JavaScript API, a React API for it that makes it easy as a JavaScript developer to basically configure the rest of your stack without having to think about it. ISR is something we were one of the first after Next to support because, you know, we thought it was really important to make it very easy for developers to configure the cache. And even before ISR, one of the things we support is something we called Edge.js, which allows you to specify the cache directly in your JavaScript code. So it wasn't sitting in VCL or some other thing that you had to manage. Once again, it's like, let's take all this infrastructure and just expose it up to the front-end developer who's in the best place to make decisions about what's cacheable and what's not, because they're controlling the experience. I think we're going off on a tangent. We should take a station break. Yeah.
I was just gonna say that. Yeah. You're reading my mind. Yeah. This is our halfway point. So we just want to encourage both you two out there, Jason and Jules, if you want to come up and talk, you're welcome to. I sent out an invite to Jason when he first joined. I don't know if you saw that or not, but if you guys want to join the conversation and you've both been listening to us yabber away, you're more than welcome to. We love making this interactive. We love having other people be part of the conversation. But otherwise, we'll probably transition into talking about JSR. Oh, looks like we got Jason, actually.
Howdy. How's it going?
Howdy.
Going good, man. Happy to hear your voice again. How's life?
Yeah, it's been this time slot has been a little busy for me for the last month, so I haven't been able to join. But it's good to be back.
Hey, we got Jules up here also. I'm not sure we've ever met before. You want to introduce yourself and let us know who you are and where you're coming from?
Yeah, can you guys hear me okay?
Yeah, crystal clear.
I just want to say it's been so GigaBrain listening to you guys chat. So much of it is over my head. I'm definitely a plebe in this space, but it's been nice to listen to you. But quick little intro. My name is Jules. I'm interested in game dev most recently because of a company I work for. It's a browser-based 3D engine that's largely built in JavaScript and TypeScript. It's kind of how I found you guys. So just here to absorb and learn and, you know, make some connections. But outside of that, I've always been building tools for creators and thinking on how to unlock the builder and everybody. So it's really, again, just stoked to be here and listening. And we'll have to run it back and Google 80% of the things that you said. But I want to take the opportunity to say what's up, and I'll pipe down from here.
Well, yeah, and I mean, I feel the same way listening to Ishan talk. So don't even worry.
No. We just happened to be on like performance, which was like my bread and butter.
Huge nerd topic for him. Yeah,
like we go off that. I mean, honestly, like TypeScript is like something I have never used day to day. Like I've programmed in typed languages, but like if we go into TypeScript, I'm just as much.
Well, this is a perfect transition, because this is one of the things that JSR, it has a couple kind of headline features. So this is going to be Dino's attempt at an NPM. And, you know, I was kind of going back and forth whether to make this a story of the week, because it's probably today not that significant, but it has the potential to be significant if it picks up. And that's kind of like the everlasting story of Dino, is this is going to be a really big deal if people actually start using it en masse, which, you know, Dino's gotten some pickups. They've gotten pickups from some pretty significant companies like Netlify and Supabase. So I think there is, you know, a case to be made for running Dino in production these days. But part of the original Dino dream was that it can kind of get us away from Node and all of its nodeness, which includes things like your package.json, includes things like NPM. And as that Dino vision has been playing out, they've kind of compromised on a lot of those things. You know, you can actually run your Node modules now in Dino. A lot of the Node APIs have been kind of backported, but I've felt that a lot of people's issues with Node are actually issues with NPM. And I think there's a very serious argument to be made for the necessity of alternatives to NPM because of what a crazy attack vector it is as like this single place where everyone's running code. Not only is everyone running code, but beginner developers who have no idea what they're doing are running code. And, you know, it doesn't have good security defaults. And this is something that we've known for a while. So that's kind of one of the things that interests me about it. And the thing that, you know, the kind of the hook to get people in, though, is like, hey, this is going to be a TypeScript first registry, which not really sure what exactly that means, but maybe it like checks your types in some sort of, you know, deployment like strategy when you're putting your modules up or something. But anyway, this is JSR. What have you heard about this, Ishan?
You know, honestly, it wasn't really on my radar as much, even though it turns out it was at the Seattle JS conference, so it was local to me in 2023. I unfortunately couldn't make that. I kind of align with you that it's, you know, could be big. I look at what, you know, Dino, what's the right way to say it? It's made the right architectural, you know, modifications. It's one of the interview questions I used to ask, or I still ask actually, is like, let's walk through something you built, right? And at the end, I'm like, okay, now what would you do differently? And this is literally what Dino, you know, team keeps doing on everything that involves Node and the whole ecosystem. But to me, the lesson of the crawling out of that ivory tower and, you know, inching back things that have Node compatibilities is just a demonstration of how much lock-in there is in the existing ecosystem of Node. There's a great blog post from this VC firm, NFX, about different types of network effects, right? We think of those as being in social networks, but they point out there can be all sorts of different kinds of you can look at everything really as a network effect.
Is this the network effects manual, 16 network effects and counting?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. It's a great one. And actually, I wanted to write a blog post for a while that was looking at the JavaScript ecosystem as social networks through that lens. You see that in frameworks. You see that in simply APIs.
So is this like Metcalfe's Law and stuff like that?
It's similar to, yeah, it's very similar to Metcalfe's Law. Metcalfe's Law is a networking. It says, you know, the more people in the network.
The more people on the network, the more valuable it gets because you get more connective nodes in between. So like you imagine a circle of nodes, and as they connect to each other, the kind of middle part becomes denser and denser with those connective lines. It's like the visual image that's always associated with it.
Well, the key observation is the usefulness of the network grows faster than the number of people. So like adding people grows, like each one adds exponentially more because of all the number of possible interconnects.
This probably connects to an idea like the tipping point. You're a Gladwellian out there.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, a good example of this is some other folks in our industry of, you know, I'll call them edge platforms have, like we do, we have an edge functions runtime, but that runtime is not Node because Node has cold starts. It also doesn't have the same isolation guarantees you would like for security and a variety of other things. And so us and a variety of other our peers are building these non-Node environments. And what ends up happening is, you know, people bring their code that, shall we say, is legacy, assumes Node, and they're like, well, it's server-side JavaScript, so it must be Node. And then they expect, you know, various parts of the Node API to be there, and they're not. And so there was a movement, I think we talked about this like 2 or 3 weeks ago, but there was a movement to amongst the frameworks to start supporting non-node environments. So like UnJS from the Nuxt team, which was, okay, build to this API, which is very minimal exposure of the node API, and then your servers that you build in our framework can run anywhere. But, you know, that movement has kind of lost a little steam and is going to take longer than I expected to emerge. And
what's interesting is actually, yeah, I think Dino had less to do with that and more these like edge runtime seems to and getting people like standard JavaScript seems to be what I've seen pushing. Like Hono is a good example of this, Hono.js, where they're like, okay, we're going to make this just based on standard like client-side JavaScript kind of APIs, and then whether you're Node, Dino, or Bun, you need to figure those out, which I think is an interesting strategy.
Yeah, so Hono is, to me, like UnJS, but I guess the point I'm coming to is the fact that those have not, I expected about a few years ago, back when we did our composability summit, we had the Nuxt folks talking about it. I expected more pickup than I've seen in the last few years. And so I think it's a demonstration of how much, I know there's some gnashing of teeth with you know, the way Dino has tried to backward support, you know, Node. And then this as a comparison, you know, like a replacement for NPM. They look like all the smart decisions, but I'll be interested to see if it lands, because I've seen lots of things architecturally that makes sense, and then you kind of have to walk back to be compatible with the social network that is NPM. And you're right.
Yeah.
They basically looked at it and said, you know, the problem may not be Node as much as it's also NPM. Let's solve that problem too. And kudos for being bold like that. But I'll be curious to see what traction it gets, given that the system is an unstated social network. That's my thought. So sorry.
Yeah. I would imagine that people coming from other language ecosystems would probably, even at the time, would probably have looked at your prediction and been like, yeah, right, man. Like, it took Python a decade. You think we're going to get there in like 2 years?
You know, I think that was also the time that, you know, I think hooks was like the only thing that has radically been taken up by an ecosystem. And that was within only React. That's probably the best, you know, you can think of example.
That's true. But I will say, when I was in my boot camp, it would have been probably year three of when Hooks was out, and they taught us both. So we still had to learn class components, which is actually way worse than just not teaching us class components at all.
Oh yeah, I can see. Yeah, that, like, here's one way, and then here's another way, and, you know.
So instead of like having one way, you can at least kind of figure out you have two ways and you don't understand either of them.
Yeah, that's, but I think to me that speaks to, they felt they need to talk to it because it was clear it was a freight train that everyone was getting on.
But at the same time, knowing that you would hit probably legacy code bases where you'd have to deal with classes,
exactly,
which is the idea behind having to teach it. Yeah. So let's transition into React. So we're running short on time here.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is, I called it React 19, the one with the compiler, because this is, that's, reminds me of, you know, it's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. They always have like the one with the blank is the episode names. And React compiler is allegedly going to be a pretty big deal. I think you could probably find the earliest video about this goes back to 2017, I believe, is when it was like first announced as being a thing. But now, taming the meta language, I think, is where they talked about that. But it's going to be something that is important enough to where there's already been other frameworks built to kind of deal with this issue. We've talked about MillionJS quite a bit,
yep,
and how that's kind of meant to address some of these things. And the idea is like excessive re-renders, because React has this model where every time it needs to, you know, update state, it kind of throws the whole DOM away and re-renders. And so this can be kind of costly and this could be a waste. So React compiler is meant to kind of address that by automating memoization, which This would be huge. This is going to be huge for someone like me who never really learned how to properly do memoization, if I'm going to be completely honest. I, you know, and this is partly, you know, my my role being more of a dev advocate who tends to build simpler demos to show people how to like spin stuff up and less about like deep performance optimization. So you, Ishan, probably know a lot more about memoization than me.
Well, I mean, the basic principle is every time you calculate something, if you know the end result of the calculation is going to be the same, you should just save that calculation, what it depends on, what its inputs are, and just, you know, save the output. And anytime you see a request for the same inputs, send the same outputs. It's really like caching in your execution code. It's just hard to do that and keep track of all the things that might be changing and what externalities there might be out there. I agree, this would be a huge lift. You should not have to think about this in most cases. I think this is long overdue. I agree, it'll be huge when it comes out. I'm just waiting. I think it'll be great. They have to obviously make assumptions. And you have to understand, you know, JavaScript is so flexible a language, it can make this hard to do. And the rules of React even say in the post, like, we had to basically, you know, assume certain things about the rules of language and the rules of React in order to make it. And what I think is hard is, like, you do this, it's one of those demos where you're like, wow, this was really great. But then if you're going to try and make it work for like all the edge cases, like imagine you're React, you're deploying, I have so much respect for the team, even though it's taken them so long. Because I can imagine it's like it sounds like a great thing in principle, but then you actually deploy it to like, you know, all the millions of people who use React and they're going to run into edge cases. And it's like, okay, which of these can we handle automatically as much as possible so that you don't have, you know, even if, I don't know, 5% of the people it doesn't work for, they'll be a loud scream. So you want to minimize that as much as possible. So I hope they get it out soon. I'm really excited for it. I think it'll be really, really, really valuable for the performance websites. It'll be interesting to see if, you know, with this, what the impact is for the performance of React sites in general. So you obviously have probably seen these comparisons that compare React versus Astro versus Quick versus Solid. And look, Solid and Astro, you know, generally are really fast. Astro, I suppose, is kind of a meta framework, so it depends what you're running on top of it. And React has had some issues. React has a very large surface area. It'll be interesting to see if like we are able to tell like the React 19 using memoization, and then you don't even know if they've turned it on. I think it'll be very useful and very valuable. When I first saw the talk, I was like, oh, this, yeah, you absolutely should be doing this. And part of this problem was it kind of fixes, we were talking about hooks, like hooks gave you a lot, kind of emphasized a lot more purely functional components. And by doing that, it became more necessary occasionally to do kind of memoization than you had to before. So I feel like that's the part that I feel is kind of overdue. Like when we rolled out more pure functional components as a way of doing things, then we needed to have given folks a way that still did rendering as efficiently as possible when those inputs weren't changing.
Yeah. I want to talk about another aspect of this blog post, actions. And then after I actually saw Jason shared a link that I think was relevant to our last discussion that I would like to get into. But just real quick, actions is, to me, this actually could be even a bigger deal if you're not someone who tends to run into a lot of memoization problems, is that this is going to allow you to do like server-side mutations, which you also wanted to hear a bit about, like, you know, Redwood V7, you know, we're in this migration from our current GraphQL kind of setup to a React Server Components setup. And like GraphQL is what gives you mutations. So this has been a huge question for me, is like, how are we going to do actions? And this essentially answers it. It's like it's going to be built in specifically to the library, and it's going to basically give everyone else the form experience that Redwood has already had, because we have all these like CLI generators that create components based on your schema, which is based on your model, and then you have all of your validation top to bottom back to your database. So like there's always been a very, very nice form experience for Redwood. And then, you know, Remix, I know, also built out this whole form abstraction that people really liked. So this could be a pretty important addition in terms of like, you're really going to have to, if you're not already migrating to React Server Components, this might be the last piece that can allow you to do it.
You know, I'd love to actually do the segue to that. What are your thoughts on, you know, Redwood 7 was, I saw the announcement, and for those who don't know, Anthony is on the Redwood team. What are your thoughts on Redwood 7 and what's the reaction like to support, you know, server components? I know you guys have started adopting it.
Yeah, well, I'll also say that I'm technically what you would call like core team alumni now, because I don't really keep up with it as much as I should or like to. I made a goal for 2024 to get back into the community, which is still kind of pending. But the main thing I would say is that actually we allow you to use fragments now, which is pretty cool, which is a GraphQL thing. But you know, it's hard because if you're going to be switching to React Server Components, it just doesn't make sense to keep doing GraphQL. So to me, there's like a fundamental paradigm shift that's happening here, and you really have to decide which one you want to do, whether you want to do GraphQL or whether you want to go all in on server components. And it's just like, it's a lot of code to rewrite if you want to migrate your app. So I think once Redwood gets all this stuff working, there's going to be another 6 months of like hardcore code mod capabilities we're going to have to build in to really make this feasible. So, you know, when they first talked about React Server Components back in like 2020, it was December 2020. I remember this very vividly. And me and Chris went and did a whole podcast about it when the first blog post dropped. And I remember saying, I have no idea how Redwood's going to deal with this, like at the time. And here we are over 3 years later, and I still don't have a lot of good answers to those questions. So it's probably a pretty bearish response, but it's the honest one, you know?
Okay, that makes sense. I mean, it's a huge change. I think other than Next, which leaned very heavily in it, all the frameworks are basically trying to figure out how they adopt to it. Is there anything else? We're coming up at the top of the hour. Is there anything else we didn't get to in, you know, when you were gathering the newsletter that fell on the cutting room floor, or anything else that you thought?
I wanted to turn to Jason. Do you want to talk about that article you shared?
Oh yeah.
No, I don't really have too much specific to share on it. I just, when you guys are talking about the alternate package registries and all the, you know, conversation going on in that space at the same time, you know, there's apparently some drama between Node itself and NPM about, you know, whether NPM is going to continue to be shipped with Node, or are they going to be more laissez-faire and let developers choose. So, and it looks like Miles from NPM, Miles Borns from NPM kind of, you know, had an on record statement about it. So I thought that was interesting.
Oh, wow. Yeah. No, this is super interesting because it's about unbundling NPM from Node, which, you know, I think that would make a lot of sense, because then maybe one day Node could use JSR, and like that would allow more synergies between the different ecosystems and the different frameworks and make things more interoperable, because I think that's pretty cool. I think that would be pretty cool if this, I have no idea if this will happen or not. I have no internal knowledge of, you know, the core team dynamics of Node. I'm just reading the tea leaves like everyone else. But, you know, Dino has been working to support Node. It could be cool if Node worked to support Dino, you know, in that kind of respect.
That'll be really, looks like looking at that article, they're going to put it to a vote. Too contentious to make a decision, and the earliest anything would happen is April 2024. That's not too far away. When was this written? How did I miss this?
This is like last week.
Oh, it was last
this
week.
Is okay. Very, this is yeah, pretty recently. Yeah,
yeah, it's very yeah, recent. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that'll be really interesting. I'll be curious to see where that lands. I agree basically with what you said, Anthony. I don't think I have anything really to add to that.
Awesome. Yeah, and you were asking about other things left on the cutting floor. There were not, but we definitely should mention, I have built out some AI examples for Edgio that I would definitely like to share with people. And if you're someone who is just like a JavaScript dev who knows how to use Next.js or even just, you know, vanilla React, this is something that you could deploy right now in like 30 seconds and get your own kind of LLM interface up and running. This is something I put a lot of work into in January and I'm really proud of. So wanted to just kind of take a second to highlight that. We have examples from LangChain, Llama Index, and Mistral. So all the cool kids on the block, if you know about the AI game, those are the cool kids.
Yeah, no, that's a great shout out. Let's see. I would add that to the Jumbotron and I'll just put it in the audio for those who aren't there. You can go to docs.edg.io, and then in the left-hand navigation, you will see something that says AI integrations. So if you're listening to the recording after this and not seeing the Jumbotron, that's how you get there. And definitely check it out. Give it a whirl. You know, send either us or Anthony directly any thoughts or comments. Really excited to have those integrations. Because I think it makes it a lot easier to utilize and orchestrate all the complexity that comes with taking a API like OpenAI's, you know, interface and actually making it useful. It's a lot of work that needs to go into that. And this will hopefully make it a lot simpler for folks.
Awesome. So as we're coming to close it out, we always give our guests the ability to kind of promote some stuff if they want. Jules, did you want to speak a little bit about On Cyber, whatever your game thing? If you were still at the keyboard, it looks like Nick Taylor just jumped in just for the end. Or Jason, if you have anything you want to promote.
I don't have anything I want to promote publicly, but the thing that's been on my mind lately is what's the developer community's position on all of these big entities scraping up all of their code and shoving it into their language models to maybe potentially eventually replace us or replace some of us.
Accelerate. Yeah.
it's the acceleration versus decel movement. I suppose you could simplify it to that, but I guess it's not a matter of to do it or not to do it, but should all of us open source contributors be compensated in some way along the as we accelerate our way to the singularity? Are we all going to get paid while money still means something?
Yeah, I mean, my thoughts on this, I think of it the same way I think about books and news articles and all that kind of stuff and music. Like, I would love to get $10 every time someone streams my demo from 2013, but I don't think that's going to happen. I don't know if it's even, you know, feasible to compensate people in any way, unless we had microtransactions, maybe. The funny thing is all these problems that exist in AI are all solved by crypto, but all the people who have all these problems are all people who hate crypto, so they're never going to realize that. That's a huge side tangent. But I think having models that can significantly improve your ability to code is enough compensation for me. Even though I'm paying $20, I would pay $100 for ChatGPT because it is that useful for me as a productive tool. So yeah, it's one of those things it would be nice if the government could pay us all living wages and we could just live on whatever, you know, but these things are, I'm not sure if it's really feasible. So that's kind of my thought.
Yeah, because I mean, there's so much you can't go more than a day or two without a news story about, you know, creative people getting, you know, either screwed over or maybe a licensing deal. Reddit's working on it's rumored to have a licensing deal, or maybe that's happened now for all their content. So content is going to be super valuable. And then I thinking about that, like probably pound for pound, what's the most valuable content on the planet today? And it's got to be source code. So, there could be, what's the value of a New York Times article versus what's the value of some JavaScript code sitting in a GitHub repository. And so it's just something I've been thinking about. And as our developers just like, hey, yeah, we're going to, Yeah, we'll catch on to the next thing, and we'll be able to ride the wave, and we won't be harmed by the, or we'll only benefit. There's only benefits for us as developers, with this coming AI revolution. But what about all the work that we've already been done? So again, that's just
right.
Something that's, I don't have any answers there, but it's just kind of the thing that's been bouncing around in my head.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we'll be able to replace most journalists before programmers, because like, someone still has to program the bot in some respect, even if it's a giant foundation model. And the question of, you saying, code being the most valuable, like a New York Times writer would certainly insist that their articles are the most valuable because they're holding truth to power and things like that. So
yeah,
everyone thinks their content is the most important.
I'm just speaking purely from code is the most valuable. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I was just speaking purely from an economic, purely capitalistic standpoint, not on terms of like humanistic or, other values, but yes.
I mean, even code, I would say you take an article that gets a million views and a code in a repo that no one has downloaded. Like, it's the brand and the interaction that could be the most valuable thing. And which has the most, it's a really hard thing to argue, but I understand where you're coming from. One is functional in a particular, very rational way. The other one, and I also don't know if we're going to replace the journalists before we replace the coders. I think both will get AI enhanced and supercharged, but it's worth noting that there is a lawsuit to try and, I think against Codex. I don't
know. It's against OpenAI, or are you talking about the New York Times, or are you talking about a different one?
There's one for when Copilot came out, for the GitHub Copilot. I don't know where that stands.
Okay, because the OpenAI one is the one with New York Times, the one that people are saying probably go to the Supreme Court. So that's the one that's going to actually set policy.
That's the most famous one. And that one, I think is a little problematic, because in that case, from what I recall, it was directly regurgitating, which is... I view that as like a bug. It's not designed to do that. It shouldn't, in theory. The tricky, slippery slope here is like, why is it like, what is it illegal about a machine to do that a person could do, right? Like, you could imagine a person in theory doing that and doing a variety of things that people say, like where it's reading 20 articles and summarizing them. Like, we ask people to do that all the time. And the existing copyright law, says certain things, like you can't copyright an idea. You can copyright a certain instantiation of it. I agree. It's a tricky issue. We'll have to figure out. I have many thoughts here, but I don't think we have enough time. And it's a very important and tricky issue. But I can see a lot of the sides here on this one.
That'll have to be next week's topic. So we'll have to unpack. There's a big blue ocean there between some of the centralized engines and some of the open source engines. And I do think that there's a solve out there, and it's interesting. It's going to be really curious to see what develops. But nothing to – I'll slightly mm-hmm. plug a little game.
No, please do. Absolutely do.
We're hosting a little game jam. It's very early, halfway closed, halfway open beta project. It kicks off this weekend, got $1,500 in prizes. But outside of that, I'd love to connect with all of you, because I learned a ton and pick your brains a little bit on what's building. And I'll definitely be here next week. Thanks for having me.
Awesome, man. Yeah, we do this every other week, so we'll be back in 2 weeks. And it's great to have you. The DMs on JavaScript Jam are always open. My own account, AJC Web Dev, is always open. It's very cool to have a game dev here, because that's actually a perspective we don't get a lot of. So, we love talking to developers working in all sorts of stuff. But I think with that, you want to close it out, Ishan?
Well, thank you everyone for attending JavaScript Jam. If you got any value from anyone here on the stage, click on their face and follow them. Do subscribe to the newsletter that Anthony puts out. Go to javascriptjam.com and click on the newsletter. You can see the past issues. We only send it out, every other week. So we're not going to spam your inbox. And then while you're there, check out some of the YouTube videos and past podcast episodes. We've had, the creators of Vite, Solid.js, and a variety of other JavaScript luminaries in past video podcasts that are worth checking out as well. And with that, thank you, everyone, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.
We'll catch you on the next one.